Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 160 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm here with three other airplane geeks as co-hosts. Let's start off with David Vanderhoof. Why don't you also tell our new listeners a little bit about yourself?
Thanks, Max. Hi, folks. I'm David Vanderhoof. I'm the resident Airplane Geeks historian. I have a background in military aviation history and a lifelong aviation geek, grew up as a military brat. I'm the show's resident expert on all things history and all things military.
That's great. And how about you, Rob Mark?
Rob Mark is a commercial pilot. I'm a former airline pilot. I'm a corporate pilot. I'm a flight instructor. I used to be an air traffic controller. I've managed not to get crazy when Dan drives me nuts on the show. I've written a bunch of books. I write for magazines. I write jetwine.com.
Wow. Let's see.
And then I have a really cool dog named Simba that Stephen Grant from Down Under seemed to have taken a shine to.
Oh, very good. That's pretty impressive. Also with us is Dan Webb.
Hi. Hi, Max, and good evening, everyone. It's great to be here on episode 160, which, if you round down, is technically pi times Rob's age. So, Anyway. So I'm a total airline dork, and I've been on the show since just as long as Rob has for the past couple of years, and it's been fun. So I'm actually in college, starting my senior year in a few weeks, and I've just always been obsessed with the airline industry, and for the past 3 or so years, I've been blogging about the airline industry over at thingsinthesky.com.
Great. I'm Max Flight. I'm a longtime jet engine guy, and I try to keep some degree of control over this little podcast. And together we talk about aviation, all kinds of things aviation. And
how do you think that control thing is working out?
Lately, not as good as it has in the past, but we gotta
keep
trying.
Just wondering. Okay.
Yeah. Each week, of course, we have a interesting guest join us. This episode, our guest is Max Trescott. I know it's going to be confusing because there's two Maxes. Max is an author. He was also the 2008 CFI of the year, and he blogs at Trends Aloft. And Max was also our guest way back in episode 59, hard to remember. Max, welcome back to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hey, that's great. As I understand that, you bring me back every 101 episodes, so I'm looking forward to see you again soon.
We were trying for 100, but we dropped the ball a little bit, so hopefully you'll understand.
No, great to be here with you.
The blog is Trends Aloft, right?
Yes, that's...
Didn't that used to be called Max Trescott on General Aviation?
Well, and actually both names resolved to the same website. I added Trends Aloft to it because that's the name of the column that I've been writing for EAA Sport Aviation magazine. So that way folks who may know me as a columnist for the monthly column can also find me on the web.
Fantastic. All right, coming up, we're going to talk about some aviation news from the past week. We're certainly going to talk with Max about what's going on in his world. We have our This Week in Aviation History segment from our own David Vanderhoof, and the Australia Desk report from Steve and Grant. They're from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast, and as our regular listeners know, supply us with a news segment each week. And we've also got Peter Johnson's Across the Pond segment. Peter brings us some news and interesting stories from the European perspective. And we'll finish off with a little bit of listener mail. So why don't we get started with the aviation news? Our first story comes from the Wall Street Journal. This is AMR to spin off regional carrier. Now, American Airlines has, according to this article, provided details of its plans to spin off the in-house regional carrier to shareholders later this year. And this divestiture is hoping to reduce the parent company's costs.
This story about AMR wanting to divest Eagle is actually a few weeks old now. It was announced at the end of July, but as one might expect, American's large order for both 737s and the brand new re-engined 737, along with A320s and A320neos from Airbus, kind of stole the show. But basically, this week, AMR provided some more information in a filing through the SEC, And this is interesting for a few reasons. First, I think this is just a continuation of a trend we've been seeing in the regional industry for the past few years. In terms of not that many mainline carriers owning regional subsidiaries. I mean, over the past few years, we've seen Delta spin off ASA. We've seen Continental selling ExpressJet. And then last year, Delta sold off Compass and Mesaba, which were acquired through its merger with Northwest, though they did not sell Comair. But so it's just interesting that we've seen this continuation of this trend. And really, there aren't that many wholly owned regional carriers by mainline airlines. There aren't that many left. The only ones I can think of are Comair, which, as I said, is owned by Delta, and also PSA and Piedmont, which are owned by U.S. Airways. The other interesting thing is this is actually AMR's second attempt at spinning off Eagle. They actually announced it a few years ago, but then decided to pull back in 2008, saying that, and they said it in 2008 that they would wait until, quote, industry conditions are more stable and favorable, unquote. So apparently, AMR now thinks that. But as Max, you mentioned, I think this is really driven by the fact that American wants cheaper feed from its regional partners. And by spinning off American Eagle, this creates some more opportunities for American to seek bids from other regional carriers. In fact, I really think there's a lot more upside to American than American Eagle, because, you know, American Eagle can now, through the spinoff, could potentially be getting new business from other mainline carriers, either through flying or ground handling business. But in my opinion, I'm not seeing a whole lot of potential there, mainly because right now Eagle's fleet, and of course they could make an order at some point, is dominated by small 40, 50 seat ERJs. And over the past few years, especially with higher oil prices, that gauge of aircraft really has waned in popularity. So one wonders exactly how much possibility there is there. And then plus, over time, American can reduce the amount of flying that Eagle has. According to this article, starting next year, American can get rid of up to 12 turboprops, which are currently ATRs, a year, and then in 2014 can start moving up to 40 jets a year. So we have that. And then also, here's a little interesting nugget in the SEC filing. Let's say Eagle does get new business from a mainline carrier. American can still benefit. But according to this SEC filing, I'll quote here, in addition, if we enter into a proposed agreement with a third party for regional flight operations using aircraft with more than 60 but fewer than 86 seats, we must notify American of the material terms of the proposed agreement, and American will reduce our rates related to the CRJ jet aircraft to match the rates in the proposed agreement. So that makes it look like Eagle Greats gets new business, gets to diversify, but American gets a cheaper rate anyway. So that, and I'm just not sure. I mean, if we look at some of the past divestitures of regional carriers by mainline carriers, I'm not sure if you could say if those carriers have really been successful on their own. I mean, when ExpressJet was sold off by Continental, ExpressJet tried to do some of their own flying, which was very interesting, but they eventually closed that down, and they did do some flying for United, but not a whole lot compared to what it did for Continental. And ExpressJet ended up getting acquired by SkyWest. And then ASA also did some flying for United, but really has stayed mainly a Delta carrier and also got acquired by SkyWest. So I'm not really sure how this will all turn out. I mean, the regional industry always gets very interesting and has some unexpected events every now and then. But
when does this guy breathe?
I know.
Sorry.
I'm waiting. Dan, it's interesting, Dan, you mentioned that, you know, most of the majors have sold off their regionals. Is it been for different reasons in each case, or is there some common reason they've all been going down this path?
To plead ignorance that will piss off Rob, but I was so young, so much younger, when ExpressJet was divested, okay, since I was still in high school at the time. But what I'll say is I think overall the mainline carriers have determined that they can still get a good quality of service from outside carriers that are competing for bids so they can be more cost effective instead of having to manage the regional carrier themselves. So that's what I would say. I think it's mainly a cost situation.
Hey, Dan, is this a standard way to divest an airline? Is you sell it to the shareholders? How do you separate the company by selling it to the shareholders? Do they suddenly make a clean break and say, with an IPO, or how does this work?
From the way I am currently reading the press release, it will be a spinoff to AMR shareholders. So they will get shares in the company, and we'll see how that goes. And I'll have to go back, but I think that's how ExpressJet ended up as well, because ExpressJet was its own entity, its own publicly traded company at the time it was acquired. So we shall see.
You said that that Eagle may well be offered to shareholders. Is that some kind of an unusual way to put it, as opposed to it's just going to be sold on the open market?
It's interesting. You know, the one question was, what did AMR actively shop Eagle, and could they not find a buyer? And Republic mentioned in their earnings call a couple weeks ago that there were some kind of high level discussions about how that acquisition would look, but nothing came out of it. And I think it could say that AMR just could not find a buyer for the airline. And I think that you could say something similar about last year, that Delta just couldn't find someone who was interested in buying Comair.
All right, let's push on. Our next story comes from the Star Tribune. This is paying for empty planes, some rural flights heavily subsidized, but defenders call it Lifeline. Now, this article mentions that there are 153 rural communities where airlines get subsidies through this Essential Air Service program. That's to the tune of $200 million total. Now, the article has a couple of examples of the sort of the effects of this, or how this operates in some cases. In one example, it says, on some days, the pilots with Great Lakes Airlines fire up a twin-engine Beechcraft 1900 at the Ely, Nevada airport and depart for Las Vegas without a single passenger aboard. And the federal...
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Ely, Nevada. Sorry.
Obviously, I've never been there.
Ely is the cheesecake, I think, isn't it?
Is there a...
An Ely cheesecake?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
And the federal government pays them to do it. So, I mean, given the current economic situation, a program like this probably has to explain itself in order to continue to get funding. Is this something that we should be keeping, or is this something whose time has come and gone?
Time has come and gone. I'm sorry. Well, with all the things that we have going on, I just cannot see how we can continue to subsidize cities that don't have enough passengers for a business to be economically viable. I mean, that just means that business just cannot exist in that place. And why do the taxpayers need that? I don't get that.
I will agree with Rob to some extent. I think in EAS, in areas like Alaska, where you have communities that really don't have, at least during certain times of the year, a viable other form of transportation, I think it can make sense. But I think also for some of the communities, one, the subsidies per passenger, and granted there are only a few, are pushing $1,000 or more. It seems to be a little excessive, especially if the airport is within a couple hours driving distance of a major airport. So I think something can at least be trimmed. And this will be interesting to see develop, especially as recently, as we discussed a few episodes ago, Delta announced they were terminating service to... their intent to adjust service, at least, to some smaller cities that were not in the EAS program that could be getting subsidized in the future, which would obviously only put more stress on the budget. So we shall see how this goes.
Can I ask a really dumb question about this?
Yes, David,
please,
of course.
Please do.
Why are they obligated to fly if they don't have anybody aboard?
Because they get paid by the flight, not by the passenger.
I don't think it's just that.
No,
I think the airplane, most likely if these airplanes are not based in these outstations like Ely, they are. I don't know. I'm not sure where they're coming out of, if that's coming out of where, Dan, maybe out of Salt Lake or out of Denver or someplace else. But they need that airplane back there at the hub to be another trip someplace else.
That and if you may have to fly it empty, like, to get to a passenger on the other end for the return trip. So,
oh yeah. Well, what would be the impact?
It still sounds ridiculous, though.
What would be the impact of this? I mean, let's say that this program ends, and so there is no federal subsidy for this. What would happen? Would these people just plain old not fly, or would this represent a business opportunity for charter flights or something like that? I mean, is there other aviation opportunity here?
I think a lot of the routes would just go away.
Yeah,
because I think these are small cities that already have very weak schedules, and I think there are plenty of passengers out there who would just happily drive instead to a larger airport that's further away with more options.
I think I'd agree with Dan on that. I mean, of course, and if let's look at it from the perspective of someone going into that town, let's say Ely, Nevada, and deciding, I'd like to open a business here, and I'd like to open a business in which I would charter an airplane and carry people from here to, you know, whatever the hub city is.
Yeah.
Even if it was a twin-engine, eight-passenger, propeller airplane, the first thing you're going to say is, where is the need? Where are the customers? Where are they going to come from? Will I have enough to fill the airplane regularly so that I can cover my costs and make a profit? And if someone says, well, no, you really can't, you'll say, well, you know what? That's probably not a great town to open a business in, because every town doesn't deserve airline service. I mean, it's only – I'm sorry. It just doesn't. And it's based on what the customers in the area are willing to pay.
But who made that determination? That airport needed airline service.
Okay, so the origination of this program came in the wake of deregulation. So basically saying if this city had service pre-regulation, it would keep service even if it were subsidized. And just to touch Rob's point a little bit further, I think that what could replace this is, and we've already seen smaller airports still kick in some kind of incentive to airlines for service, whether that be some kind of reduced fees or helping out with advertising. So we could certainly see more of that, and there's still some kind of subsidy, just not on a federal level.
Hey, Max. Well, I was just going to ask Max Trescott this question. What about a federal subsidy for flight schools that would teach people how to? Wouldn't that be a great idea? I mean, but you think anybody would go along with it?
Yeah, I think the word federal subsidy is about to be outlawed. I don't think anybody wants to subsidize anything anymore.
Yeah.
Except if you're a member of Congress and it helps your district.
Well, good point.
We have an article from the Los Angeles Times. This is Falcon Hypersonic Vehicle Test Flight Fails. Now, we had another flight of this vehicle. It's called the Falcon Hypersonic Technology Vehicle. And this was the second one. This is an aircraft that's supposed to travel at 20 times the speed of sound. David, why do we need an aircraft that's that fast?
We need an aircraft that fast because sometimes we need a priority target on the ground on the other side of the world, and we don't have the 1 or 2 hours to take out that priority target. For example, we originally had a chance to take out Osama bin Laden here in the United States based on actionable intelligence. And by the time we launched the cruise missiles, it was 3.5 hours later, and he was gone. In this case, you'd be able to launch a missile from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California and in 16 minutes have a shell land on that camp in Afghanistan. But the problem with that is you need to be able to direct the aircraft to the target. And currently the DARPA does not, or the United States government does not have the ability to do so. We're really good at launching it into space. We're really good at launching the payload towards the ground.
Right.
But guiding it about at Mach 20, which is 20 times the speed of sound, we seem to not have that part down yet.
Mm.
So this is the second test. The first one occurred in April 2010. The craft did get up to 20 times the speed of sound, but promptly we then lost contact with it. And DARPA, the Defense Agency Research Projects Administration, said that it crashed harmlessly in the Pacific, but there's no indication that they really know where exactly in the Pacific it did crash.
Probably there are quite a few people looking for it right now. This is an unpowered vehicle.
Well, not...
In other words, it's launched to altitude, or at least this Falcon test vehicle is launched to altitude and then does, glides, it, right, at Mach 20?
It does glide, but part of it is controllable. It's not like the space shuttle where you just sort of aim it and it entered reorbit and came back to Earth. This has got what they call reaction control jets, or RCSs, where you're supposed to be able to direct this and fly it. That's the problem right now. The telemetry, the fly the aircraft, once you get it started, doesn't seem to work, and they lose control of the aircraft. So it does have a way to be powered, but it's launched into orbit by the rocket, then deployed, and then directed towards the target. It flies really, really fast. Like one of the headlines says, flies really, really fast, but gets lost.
And this is a pretty high-tech endeavor. I mean, the article points out that the surface temperatures on this thing reach about 3,500 degrees.
What is this thing made of?
I think it's a carbon fiber.
Wow.
At least partially. And it must have some titanium.
Carbon composite like material.
Yeah. So that's probably where a lot of the technology is in this, and that's probably the part where you won't find very much information.
Really, it's the future of being able to launch a intercontinental attack and not use nuclear weapons. It's a kinetic weapon, which means it kills by just its speed and force.
Its impact, huh? And I think this is the end of the funding for it at this point in time. Isn't that right, David?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's run out of money, so they've had two unsuccessful flights. So maybe, but like as said previously earlier in the show, there's not much money for anything currently.
So again, we're here with Max Trescott. Max, people call you an advocate for general aviation. Is that an accurate title, and is that one that you promoted, or have you just been tagged with that?
Yeah, it's probably an accurate description. I think that probably all of us as pilots need to become advocates for general aviation, because we're just being attacked on so many fronts. So I like to help promote the idea that all pilots should be advocates for protecting our industry.
How can pilots do that? I mean, what do you recommend people do?
Well, I think probably the key thing is just to be totally have your eyes wide open, looking for any news items or any new threats that may become on the horizon, whether it's at your local airport, whether somebody wants to build a housing development and close a particular runway, so that might be involved by getting involved in local committees, either in the city council or in the airport commission, things like that on a local level, as well as national level, kinds of things as well. So, for example, I guess it was about a year and a half ago, almost 2 years ago, that TSA was trying to promote the large aircraft security program, LASP.
Yes. Right.
And so many of us tried to mobilize people around the country to post comments. I believe that particular proposal actually had the most number of comments ever filed on an NPRM, a notice of proposed rulemaking. So basically, until that point in time, I think the TSA had never run into any kind of resistance to putting new things into place, and that was the first time I think that they realized, pilots are not happy with unreasonable restraint of our activities.
Yeah, I consider that to be a success on the part of the advocating pilot interests.
Yeah, and I've heard that we'll be seeing a revised version of that program coming out relatively soon. And the one thing I have heard is that rather than applying it to aircraft 12,500 pounds and above, that they've moved that limit to probably somewhere in the 30,000 to 40,000 pound limit. So yeah, there's some changes that have been made, and I think that's all because pilots have become involved.
What either Max or Rob, at the 30,000 pound kind of level, what kind of aircraft are we talking about?
Well, Rob, you probably know better than I.
30,000 pounds, that's a Hawker 800. That's a, too small to be a Falcon. What else? Citation Sovereign, I think, would be about that weight. Somewhere in there, eight passenger jet, roughly.
So certainly the Gulf Streams are all going to be above that, up as high as the 75,000 pound level and so on. But yeah, it would like let most King Airs, for example, would no longer have to be covered by it.
Let's be serious. Max has a very good point in the sense that the only reason it's different from what the original proposal was because of that 7,000 plus comments that people from the industry mobilized, and all the aviation organizations got together and got people to do that, and that was no small challenge. But everybody kind of pulled together, and I don't know, Max, I haven't seen that happen very often. Have you?
No, but I think increasingly as pilots, we're going to have to try and do that more often. I just think there are more threats on the horizon. So one of the good things that came out of that was that the GA caucus was formed on Capitol Hill. So, I think that was the time where the different alphabet organizations decided, boy, we really need to line up our friends on the Hill now, because those are the ones that control the purse strings for a TSA. And ultimately, that's, I think, where the control authority comes. TSA, just as an example agency, I don't mean to pick on them, could ignore us if they chose to. But at the end of the day, once we have a GA caucus that's supporting aviation, then they're going to take us very seriously because they know we've got support on the Hill.
So tell me about the GA caucus. Who, how is that organized, or how does the aviation community get its views reflected by that caucus?
Sure. So in the House, Congressman Sam Graves is the leader, and I don't even remember the number of congressmen who signed on in the House, but it's many dozens. I just can't remember. And in the Senate, they've also got an equivalent version, obviously smaller number. But I would say that somewhere on the order of maybe a quarter of all the senators have signed on to it. So it's significant numbers, and as you'd expect, it's often the states with strong aviation type interest, where members have signed on. And you may have seen it in the past. Organizations like AOPA have encouraged members to encourage their local representatives to sign on the caucus. So basically, it's an alliance on the Hill among senators and congressmen that says that they're going to support GA, and that we've got an open ear there. So it's nice to have a formal structure in place to air our concerns.
And you know what's an interesting point about this too is that I was just looking this up as Max was talking, and I went through the members of the House in Illinois, because our local congressperson here in Chicagoland, Jan Schakowsky, joined, or at least she told me she did. Yeah. And as of the most recent list here, she's not on it.
Uh-oh.
So either there's an error on the list, or a Democrat, Jan Schakowsky from north side of Chicagoland, is not there. I'll have to look into that.
Yeah.
She's guys, I got a question. This is a question for Rob and Max. Max T, not Max F. Do we have any congressional pilots in Congress? Do we have anybody with a GA background?
I know we did have one or more congressmen who were pilots, but I think we actually lost some in the last the set of elections. So, for example, I know that Kay Bailey Hutchins from Texas, her husband is a pilot, so obviously she's pretty tightly connected there. But I don't believe she's there currently. So I don't know who we do have currently at pilots on the Hill.
We'd have to look on the AOPA list, which is what I was talking about when the system died on us here. But we can,
evidently we'll get that information is classified.
No, we'll get that for next show, though. I'll make sure I dig that up.
So, Max, what other issues are you involved in these days?
Well, for example, here in California, which is known as a progressive state that sounds unfriendly to business, they are using their reputation to make life a little bit more challenging for the GA flight instructor industry. So we had a bill that was passed in late 2009, AB 48, which unfortunately, there are some amendments which are trying to be passed now, but basically what it required is that all flight schools going forward would need to pay a $5,000 registration fee, pay almost 1% of their revenues every year to the state, and produce audited financial statements, which the estimates were would cost about $25,000 per year. And this applies not just to flight schools, but guess what? To independent flight instructors as well. So you can imagine that you know, most independent flight instructors would fold up their tents and you know, stop doing that unless there's a change which is going to occur. And the flight instructors and flight schools have been working really hard along with some of the alphabets here over the last year and a half to come up with an exemption to that. And we're kind of on the cusp of getting that passed. Hasn't quite you know, cleared the legislature yet, but the proposed exemption is that schools and CFIs who accept less than $2,500 in prepayments with no contracts would be exempt from that, which would really help a lot. The background on this was that there were some very high-profile failures of flight schools in which literally millions of dollars of prepaid flight school fees were lost, and basically the legislature here in California decided to act. And they did so in a manner that really swept in a lot of folks like me who were, you know, not taking $50,000 in advance from someone who wanted to, you know, go from zero to ATP in 9 months.
So it was kind of a consumer protection move. That was the motivation for it.
Exactly right. So we were swept in with truck driving schools and beauty parlor schools and anybody else who accept money as I think they called it post-secondary education, but you know, think of it as kind of vocational school.
Yeah, sure.
So obviously, when you sign up for some of those kinds of schools, already being intelligent is not necessarily a criteria for getting in, I guess, right?
Well, I think the real problem is it's hard for someone who's signing up as a student at any of these schools to know if they prepay large amounts of money, whether they're going to get back or whether the school's going to go bankrupt. So it's
I understand that, but I guess what I'm trying to figure out is that in life in general, who would pay up front that kind of money to having no idea who these organizations really are?
Well, and the worst part is that many of these people didn't pay $40,000 and $50,000 up front. They got a loan to do it, and now not only did they not get flight training, but they're still legally on the hook to pay off the loans. So there are a lot of folks who really got screwed.
You know, Max, when it comes to flight training, Rob has mentioned, and some of our guests have talked in the past about the high rate at which students drop out of flight schools. And we've kind of speculated on some of the reasons for that. Do you have some thoughts on that? Are you seeing the same thing? Do you see a lot of students drop out?
You know, I probably less so for me personally, for a variety of reasons. You know, I tend to be working with folks who are, they're older. You know, they're in their 40s and their 50s, and they're, you know, often high-level folks in corporations, and they're highly motivated and, you know, have plenty of money. And so they don't have many of the other reasons that you know, people might have to drop out. But, you know, for example, I look at the research that AOPA did about 9 months ago, and I think that was the first really in-depth study that was done in the industry to identify the unique factors that were contributing to, you know, the high dropout rate. And one of the big areas that they identified was, you know, on the instruction side. So, for example, a big item was that, you know, many people felt that their instructors were not using any type of a syllabus. And so they, as a student pilot, were totally lost as to where they were in the process and, you know, how it was going. One of the lesser factors was just a sense of community. They wanted to have a way to communicate with other people in a similar situation, kind of mutually supportive way to, you know, feel good about where they were in the process. And you know, part of it's also recognition. I think that they identify that aviation really looks a lot like a clubhouse with a door that's pretty well closed. And you know, when potential pilots walk in the door, you know, they're often not warmly greeted at flight schools and welcome into our little club with our own you know, special acronyms and, you know, ways of talking and our fancy leather jackets. And so, you know, in one area in particular they identified was that, you know, women in particular, you know, find that a little daunting. But I think it's daunting for all people in general. So, yeah, there are a number of issues. On the other side, the flip side, what they identified was that despite all of this, an extremely high percentage of people, even people who dropped out, were very positive about the experience. So flight training is something that people absolutely love and they're, you know, very proud to have been involved in, even if they've dropped out, which is pretty remarkable.
Are there opportunities these days for, you know, younger folks who maybe don't have the kind of financial resources that others have who are interested in flying? Is it even feasible?
I think it is feasible, and I think they have to work harder to figure out how to do it, which is actually probably true for just about every industry. I think everybody has to work a little harder than perhaps the prior generation may have had to. Certainly with all the physical fences, and I mean that literally around the airport, it's a little harder for people to hang out on their bicycle and get offered a ride in an airplane. Yeah. And so I think people who want to become pilots, they're going to have to work even harder to find opportunities, but I think they still exist.
Well, that's good. I mean, I certainly hope so. We want to see our young folks become interested in not just as pilots necessarily, but in aviation in general, and find opportunities and ways to get into the field, into the profession.
You know, if I can throw a question at Max. I mean, Max, something that I've heard mentioned more than once is that with the cost of flying being as high as it is, and I'm not by any stretch of the imagination saying that it's the only reason that people don't fly, but with the cost of flying being high, that the group of people who will eventually become professional pilots are simply not necessarily the best pilots or the smartest pilots, but they're the ones that somehow had some sort of financial wherewithal to get their training funded, and I'm just curious if, you know, looking down the road, if you think that makes any sense, or if you've ever run across anything like that.
Yeah, I think there's probably some truth to what you say. I mean, if you look at institutions of higher learning, universities, who are the folks who are most likely to get into those? Well, the folks who have the money to pay the tuition. Not that there aren't lots of scholarships and things like that, but yeah, I mean, I've actually heard of gentlemen airline pilots, people who've retired, they're independently wealthy, but they think it's cool to be a regional airline pilot. And so it doesn't matter to them that they're, paid, fairly poorly compared to what we'd like to think of as a reasonable standard for paying airline pilots. So, I don't know how much of a trend that's going to be overall, but, let's just take a look at it at the extreme. The extreme would be, cycle forward 50 years from now, maybe all our airline pilots will be outsourced. Maybe it'll be like the call centers, when you pick up, the phone to get assistance on your PC instead of, reaching someone here in the States, you reach someone in another country. And it's entirely possible that, we could end up with a much higher percentage of, foreign pilots flying here in the U.S., just as kind of one outlandish of example of where this could go if you took it to the extreme.
Well, and think about the point you just made about colleges and universities. I mean, having a daughter that's approaching college age and starting to have those heart attacks every night as you go to bed reading the brochures, thinking about how great they could be, but how it's never going to happen because nobody can afford it. I mean, there are scholarships available. There are universities and colleges that want students enough that they're willing to put some money into the kitty to get them there. But the aviation industry doesn't do that. They never really have they?
Yeah, if you're talking about the airline industry here in the U.S. isn't really kind of growing their own set of pilots, much like the we see in Europe where a lot of those airlines do grow their own pilots.
Yeah, or in Asia. I mean, another region. But I seriously question whether we're not going to have to go that route. But the regionals are going to start running short of people.
Yeah, it's a long-term issue, and I think they've kept their head in the sand about it. And so far, they've managed to be able to do that.
Max, I have a dumb question for you.
But questions.
Well, wait a minute. Can I just interrupt with one thing, Dan? I mean, we all do this. I think we should stop saying that we have dumb questions. They're not dumb questions. We all do that.
I wholeheartedly agree.
So, Dan, let's restart that.
Okay. Max, I have a quick idiotic question for you.
I doubt it, but go ahead.
As a GA advocate, my question is, and no one's really asked me this before, but where I go to school, there's an airport maybe 10 minutes away. And let's say one of my friends at school asks me about that. I mean, how do you explain a GA airport or just GA in general to someone whose only exposure to aviation is the occasional airline trip and how important the industry is?
Yeah, I think that general aviation as a name is probably a pretty poor name for our industry. It doesn't really describe exactly, what it is. And so you might have to explain that general aviation is essentially, all other flying, except for airline and military and kind of public service, the cops up flying around and stuff like that. So that's going to be anybody who's flying an air ambulance or anybody who's fighting a forest fire or anybody who's learning to fly an airplane on their own. So yeah, you could explain to them that the kind of GA is everything except airlines and military kind of stuff. And why do we need it? Because there are just a lot of services that are not provided by the airlines that the GA fills a need for. So for example, you were talking earlier about all those cities like Ely, Nevada. It may be that if they no longer subsidize flights out of Ely, that some Part 135 charter operation will come into place to still provide some type of service in and out of Ely. So you think of GA as kind of the service that fills in the gaps that the airline and the military don't fulfill.
But if I can add one thing to that, we also don't want to lose sight of what we've also been discussing before this question, Dan, is that a GA airport is where everybody that flies for the airlines today probably learned to fly. I mean, they don't learn to fly at O'Hare. They don't learn to fly at Atlanta Hartsfield or Kennedy or Miami or any place like that. They go to a little GA airport. It might even be a grass strip somewhere where they fly a little single-engine airplane and fly with a flight instructor and build their hours and gain ratings. And that's how they eventually get to the airline part. And without that element of support, the airline industry is going to come to a grinding halt. They really will, except that nobody at the airline believes that.
No, that's a very good point, especially because, I thought all you needed was 20 hours of Microsoft Flight Simulator and you were good to go.
Well, that's all Max and I needed because we were really cool dudes.
Max, are you participating in the pilot training reform symposium?
So you're referring to the one that was held in Georgia back in May. Yeah, I put together a presentation for that, and unfortunately, I got sick and I had to cancel my trip out there. But yes, that was put on by SAFE. They were the leaders in that Society of Airline Flight Educators, and I'm a member of SAFE. And yes, that's something I've been involved in. There's another symposium somewhat similar, which will be coming up in March in St. Louis, which is being led by Jim Campbell out of aero-news.net.
Oh, yes, sure.
And I think the common thread in both of these initiatives is to try and, much like the AOPA study did, to look and try and find out what are the factors that are holding GA back from growing, and how can we address those, and what kind of changes as an industry can we make to keep our industry from shrinking.
Fantastic. Any other issues that we wanted to cover? There are things that you're doing, Max, that we want to talk about a little bit?
What do you want to be when you grow up, Max?
Just like you.
No, he doesn't.
Should we get into a discussion about social media and missing videos?
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah, Max, whatever happened to that puppy, baby?
Puppy? Good point. Sure.
I think it'd be a great idea to mention that you came out, and let's just, David, you were there too. I mean, why don't you just kind of mention that Max walked in with a bunch of cameras and stuff one day, and I don't know.
This was at AirVenture.
Yeah.
At AirVenture, Max, we were privileged. Actually, folks, the tides are turning because some of us were actually interviewed by Max Trescott, not Max Flight, at AirVenture about social media. Max, you want to talk a little bit about your experience interviewing us?
Well, sure. Let me put the background on it. First, EEA hired me, as they did last year, to come out and work with a camera crew and a sound man. So Dave Marks and Nick Nebel, who have been doing that for 27 years. And over the course of a week, the three of us put together 55 interviews. And the one that was probably the most fun was my 60 Minutes Mike Wallace ambush interview, which is when we left AirVenture proper, where all of the corporations with their large buildings and pavilions and large presence and large PR firms had set up. And we drove in our golf carts way out into the back 40, way out to Camp Scholar, where we found the mytransponder.com RV, which was hosting you folks, a lot of other podcasters and social media folks. And we had great fun just kind of popping in, opening the door and seeing who was there and interviewing all you folks on video. So it was probably, I thought, probably the most fun interview we did the whole week.
And so we're just waiting to see the results of that, huh?
Well, exactly. You know how media is instantaneous and it only takes about a month to get it up.
Right, exactly.
No, the issue we faced is that we produced so much work that there's now a a backlog in terms of getting that stuff posted. Sure. So EAA greatly expands their video department for the week of AirVenture, and then those people kind of disappear, except for one or two people who are on staff. So it's now the people on staff who are doing the rest of the work. So I hope.
I thought he was about to say that Rob and I broke the cameras.
No. Why are you
including me in that?
I've actually asked them to prioritize two videos. That video that I did with you folks, and I hate to say this, but with the reality stars from Alaska Flying Wild, which Ariel Tweedo and those guys are so much fun that I just had to ask that we get that video up quickly too. Love that TV show.
That's great. Okay, Max Trescott, thank you very much. The website is maxtrescott.com, TRESCOTT.com. And there you can find Max's blog postings, also the books that you sell, quite a variety of other information.
Been a lot of fun. Thanks so much for having me, and we'll see you 101 episodes from now.
I hope it's sooner than that. Thanks again, Max.
Thank you.
Now we have our own David Vanderhoof, the official Airplane Geeks historian, with This Week in Aviation.
Thanks, Max. And for all you new listeners, this is my weekly 5 minutes to tell you all the things that happened during the upcoming week. So welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 3, Episode Number 23, August 14th through the 20th. August 14th through the 23rd, 1932. A small Curtiss Thrush airplane takes off for an endurance mission. The Model 56 was a high-wing cabin monoplane. The aircraft would make an endurance flight of a record of 196 hours. The two crew would complete 78 air-to-air refuelings. A hose would be lowered down manually to pump gas into the Thrush's tanks. Twice a day, the crew would make a national radio broadcast from their tiny aircraft. Sandwiches and other food were lowered to the cabin by ropes from another aircraft. New York reporters christened the aircraft the Flying Boudoir. That did not change the fact that Francis Marsalis and Louise Thaden broke the endurance record then held by men by a whole 73 hours. August 15, 1940, Großtag from Operation Aldertag, or Eagle's Day, the World War II German Luftwaffe puts up the largest force of aircraft to attack Great Britain in an effort to break the back of the RAF. All the attacks were against RAF airfields or radar installations. Five actions accounted for the day's activities. 100-plus aircraft at 1,100, followed by 70-plus at 1,200. Later in the afternoon, there were three more waves that occurred with 200, 400, and 100 aircraft actions each. The result of this was the RAF put up 672 aircraft to defend the attacks. The Luftwaffe lost 153 aircrafts with 113 more damages or possibly destroyed. This was in comparison to the RAF losing only 38 aircraft and 18 pilots. The battle would start to change in RAF favor going forward. August 15th, 1973. A strike mission flown by A-7D Corsairs, 2s, of the 354th Tactical Fighter Squadron returned to Royal Thailand Korat Air Force Base. The mission is significant because it marks the last official United States Air Force operation over Cambodia. The mission marks the conclusion of 160 days of operations where F-4 Phantoms and A-7Ds had dropped over 240,000 pounds of ordnance. August 18th, 1903. Carl Yatho flies his motor Draken for a brief hop. Yatho's glider is equipped with a 10-horsepower motor driving a pusher propeller. Hanover, Germany now claims that he was the first to fly, not the Wrights, by 4 months. His wings were based on the Zadona seed, which flies very stable. Eventually, Jatha would produce a successful aircraft in 1909 that was fully controllable. If you want to hear more of the history, go to the show notes. As a postscript, Richard Pierce still holds the record for the first non-photographed flight on March 21st, 1902. August 18th, 1960, a C-119 flying boxcar snares Discoverer 14 from the air, recovering the satellite. Discoverer was part of a CIA DARPA program to use spy satellites over mainland China and the Soviet Union. The Corona, or KH-01, or Keyhole satellite, would be launched via a Thorogena rocket. fly a ballistic trajectory over the target while taking photographs. The photographs were taken using film. At the end of the mission, the capsule would return from orbit and re-enter, then deploy a parachute. The recovery aircraft would be directed to the parachuting capsule by telemetry. A large nylon rope would be winched out of the back of the aircraft. The pilot would then fly the aircraft below the capsule, making the capsule fall into the center of the net, then accelerate. The rope would snag and drag the capsule, and it was winched into the aircraft to recover the film. This system would continue through to the 1980s, with payloads growing from 70 pounds up to 1,100 pounds. Eventually, the system would be replaced by real-time transmitted data. A variation of this was the Skyhook, in which a man attached to a balloon would be launched and then snagged using much the same system. August 20th, 1986, a Boeing 727-200 makes the first flight with the GE-36 UDF engine. The unducted fan engine was a way to provide more fuel efficiency and economy without a turbofan engine. The GE-36 was based on the successful GE-404 military engine. While the flights were successful, the engine never took off. Originally, it was supposed to be on the MD-94X by McDonnell Douglas and the 7J-7 by Boeing, which became the 787. However, it never went beyond the test phase. Pratt Whitney Allison had the 578DX, and Rolls-Royce had the RB-3011, and they also began to produce similar engines with similar results. First flights that occurred during the week of August 14th through August 20th. The Northrop XP-89 Scorpion, August 16th, 1948. The North American NA-40 or B-25 Mitchell, August 19th, 1940. The Boeing Vertol 234, the civilian version of the CH-47D Chinook, August 19th, 1980. The BAC-111, and yes, I wrote out 111, August 20th, 1963. The Sikorsky X-67 Blackhawk, August 20th, 1970. This was the competitor to the Lockheed Cheyenne, not the current Blackhawk, which is the S-70 or UH-60. The Aerospatiale Fuga 90, August 20th, 1978. And the British Aerospace Sea Harrier Mark I, August 20th, 1978. And that's the way it was, August 14th through August 20th. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Thank you, David. You know, I always thought it was amazing that you could actually retrieve, you know, returning satellites with an airplane. Was the success rate of that very high? Do you have any idea? Did they ever miss any of those?
I think they did miss it. The Discoverer capsules were designed to float temporarily. One of the interesting notes I found out was that their capsules had a plug that was dissolved by seawater.
Huh.
So it would float. It would float for like 2 hours, enough time to get a ship to it. If the ship couldn't make it, then it would sink to the bottom, never to be found.
So no one else could retrieve it.
Yep.
Clever. Okay. Here's the Australia Desk Report.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline August 14th, 2011. Well, g'day folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 160 of the Airplane Geek Show. I'm Steve Vischer, just back in the country now for a few days, doing it solo this week. Grant McHaren is not able to join us. He's quite busy at the moment. In fact, here in Melbourne, we're having some late winter, very nice late winter weather, actually. And when it's good weather here and blue skies, that means the balloons are flying, and flying a lot. And Grant, and his job as an operations manager at a balloon company, well, that just means he's been flat out, and he's obviously had to play catch-up since getting back from Oshkosh. He's been back in the country about a week and a half longer than me, but yeah, he's had a lot of catching up to do, so we'll have to make do without Grant tonight, and unfortunately I haven't even got virtual Grant queued up tonight, so we'll just have to make do without him. Now, at about 5:30 on Thursday morning Melbourne time, as my V Australia 777 touched down at Melbourne and taxied past the Tiger Airways ramp on its way to the terminal, I did note with well, what I thought was some sadness that, gee, it's as much as I don't like Tiger Airways, it is pretty sad to see all these A320s all buttoned up and darkened, their terminal obviously looking quite deserted. And it brought me back to some comments that I was making on last week's Airplane Geeks show about Tiger Airways and my thoughts that they would probably never come back. In fact, most of our Australian listeners will no doubt recall Compass Airways Mark 1 and Mark 2, both of which failed miserably. And it was my thought last week, in fact, that Tiger Airways was probably destined to join join them. Well, as it turns out, that's not the case. This from ABC News.
It's been a long 6 weeks for Tiger Airways, which has been grounded ever since two incidents in June where the Civil Aviation Safety Authority says Tiger Airways pilots came in too low to land at Melbourne Airport. Ever since then, the airline has been trying to reassure the safety regulator that it's safe to fly. Well, today it took to the skies again in a limited capacity, three flights between Sydney and Melbourne.
And yeah, interesting, those three flights, about one third full. Well, that's hardly surprising given that Tiger Airways has not been able to take any bookings. Now, John McCormick is the spokesman for the Civil Aviation Safety Authority here, and he's talking about some of the conditions that have been imposed on Tiger Airways, which is going to allow them to get back in the air, at least in some limited capacity for now.
CASA will carry out extra surveillance on Tiger's flights through scheduled and spot checks. CASA inspectors will look at Tiger's operations in the air and on the ground. On some flights, our flying operations inspectors will be in the cockpit observing the performance of Tiger's crews.
Yeah, so that's pretty tough talk there from CASA, and, you know, it's no wonder. Obviously, they had a lot of concerns there, and as Grant and I have speculated, and many other commentators too have speculated, there must have been more to it than just two landings coming in below the minimum safe altitudes there. That's obviously the straw that broke the camel's back. There must have been a lot of other things going on in the background. John McCormick goes on to say here that the Civil Aviation Safety Authority found missing, incomplete, and outdated documentation relating to pilot training, operational procedures, and maintenance oversight, amongst other problems. He says the safety authority could not determine the currency of pilot training from the poorly kept records. And in fact, all of Tiger's 110 pilots have had to be put through proficiency training and retraining in the simulators. Now, it's also interesting here that during that retraining, McCormick says that a very small number of the pilots failed some aspects of that retraining, and they're having to take some more remedial training. Now, CAS has also imposed some pretty strict conditions on such things as pilot training, crew rostering, document control, which is probably one of the things that led to this in the first place, and maintenance oversight. And it's also looking for the appointment of more qualified and experienced senior personnel in all of these areas. So there's some real aspects of concern here that they've been looking at over these last 6 weeks. One of the other interesting things I've noted here is that they've required all of Tiger's crew bases to be consolidated to one base that's here in Melbourne. Now, that's pretty interesting in itself. And in fact, for the time being, and at least for the rest of August, Tiger is only going to be allowed to fly 18 sectors a day, which really equates to 9 return flights. And that's for the rest of August. And that's a huge reduction in their usual operating capacity, which had them doing about 60 flights a day. And interestingly here too, it also means that the Tiger may have to consider culling a number of ports from its route network, which is something I've been talking about for a long time. Now, some of the figures here are quite staggering. $12 million in losses for Tiger Airways during this 6 week stand down, and an estimated $13.6 million in lost advance ticket sales. So let's hope that now they're back in the air, that things can only look up from here for Tiger Airways. Now, the next quick thing I'll talk about here is Strategic Airlines. Now, Strategic is a very, very small carrier here in Australia, and we mentioned them a few weeks ago. And they've been making some announcements in the media over the last few weeks and months about perhaps changing their name for a start. And they're also looking for some slots to start some trans-Pacific flights. Well, actually, this week in the media, they've announced that they'll be commencing Honolulu flights, actually, from Brisbane and Melbourne. So good on Strategic Airlines for that. Now, they're going to be going into a very, very saturated and highly competitive market there, operating across the Pacific, but I guess more competition will make things all the more interesting across that route. These services will be starting from December 14th, and they're looking at one-way fares from Melbourne at about $599 Australian and ex-Brisbane for $499. So pretty competitive fares there. I think that'll set them up pretty well against the likes of Qantas, Jetstar and Virgin. So yeah, we'll follow that one with interest. They haven't changed their name yet, so one wonders whether that's still on the cards or whether they're still shopping that one around to see what they can come up with. Now, the other one quickly that I wanted to talk about here was Virgin Australia. While Qantas at the moment is in pitched battles with its union over pay rises and all sorts of other aspects of that industrial agreement, that's a very, very complex set of issues going on there at Qantas. Well, Virgin pilots, on the other hand, should be celebrating at the moment. In fact, their chief executive, John Borghetti, has just agreed to a series of pay rises for them over the course of their new agreement. I believe that's a three-year agreement, which provides for pay rises of up to 28%. So although Virgin pilots are not paid as much as Qantas mainline pilots, generally speaking, I think they'll be quite happy with that. That's quite a generous pay rise, it would seem. So, yeah, I guess things are pretty happy on that side of the equation for Virgin pilots. Now, while Grant hopped on an American Airlines flight back to Los Angeles and then hopped on the V Australia flight back to Melbourne, well, I had about an extra week and a half in the United States to travel around and do some other things that I've been hoping to work on while I was there, and did a lot of time traveling around with Southwest. In fact, I flew them from Little Rock to Dallas, and then the next day, Dallas to San Francisco. And one thing that always strikes me about Southwest is the enthusiasm of their staff. They all seem almost unnaturally happy, but yeah, very refreshing to see. And one of the flight attendants I came across was a senior flight attendant by the name of Bruce Campbell. He had a pretty funny comedy spiel going on there for the in-flight safety demonstrations and all the other announcements. Really, really funny stuff. Well, while we were stuck at Los Angeles, in fact, we had about an extra 90 minutes of downtime there that we hadn't expected. Well, I decided to pull Bruce aside up on the jetway there, and he was good enough to do a quick cameo for us. So I'll just play that now.
Hey, this is Bruce Campbell, Southwest Airlines flight attendant. Been flying with him for 19 years, based now in Dallas. Sometimes we do little things different, have a little fun. Obviously, we enjoy our jobs, but I've somewhat done a pretty good deal with it. Some of the announcements and the voices I do kind of gets people's attention on trying to demonstrate some of the safety features. For instance,
now listen up. This is a good friend, Ross Perot. Now, I'm not doing this here for myself. See, I'm doing it for my kids and my grandkids. Now, I don't need the money. I'm a billionaire. Now, just remember, United we stand, but Southwest we fly.
George Senior here. How you doing? Didn't have a job. Nobody wanted me in the White House. Not good. Not good. Thought I'd try that old flight attendant thingy-dangy there. Pass out peanuts and drinks. It's good. Good for the economy. Read my lips. Stay seated. It's prudent at this juncture.
You're on behalf of Southwest Airlines, this entire flight crew,
and the people from California,
we would like to welcome you to Los Angeles. Remain seated with your seatbelts fastened. Remember, we're here for your safety. We're here to buckle you up. Should the mask come down, just put it over your nose and mouth, securing it with the elastic strap. And just like Monica, suck real hard.
Oh, you can't say that one. Never mind. You can't say that one. Anyway, some of the fun stuff I do here at Southwest. Again, been doing it for 19 years. Great company. Lots of fun. And I think we're one of the only majors making money. So come on out to the U.S., give us a try, and ask for some extra nuts.
Yeah, big shout out there to Bruce Campbell. It was very nice of him to do that for us. But some of the safety demonstrations were made all the more humorous and actually got your attention and gets you watching them, actually, which is quite an interesting strategy. I don't know whether that's an unintended consequence, but it certainly does get you up there and watching the safety demonstration, which is the whole point of the exercise, I guess. But big shout out there to Bruce Campbell. I really appreciate that. And he made a very long flight quite enjoyable and quite relaxing. And if the people at Southwest New Media team are listening to the Airplane Geeks, well, I really think you should single Bruce out for some special treatment next time you see him. Really good guy. Well, I think I'll leave it there for this Australia desk. It's a little bit different doing it solo, isn't it, without Grant around to bounce off, but we'll have Grant back in the seat next week. But until then, I'm Steve Fisher. Cheers, folks.
All right, thank you, Steve Fisher, for the Australia Desk Report. We'll look forward to the return of Grant next week.
I don't know. I mean, maybe you're looking forward to having Grant
sure,
back.
Of course we are.
I mean, I thought it flowed kind of nicely. Who was Steve talking to all the time?
I have a question. Do you think they can go? Do you think they could go a week without talking about Tiger Airlines?
No, Tiger's just too much material. Now here's Peter Johnson with his Across the Pond segment on European aviation.
You're listening to Across the Pond, coming to you from the front seat of an Airbus.
Terrain, pull up.
Today we're joined by Steve, who's an Airbus A320 pilot. Steve talked to us in an earlier show about flying the Airbus in Europe and how he went through his training to become a commercial pilot. Today we're going to talk about simulator proficiency. Steve, welcome back to Across the Pond.
Thanks for having me again, Peter. Nice to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. Steve, can we start by understanding the process you have to go through to stay concurrent?
Sure. I mean, we have to go in the simulator twice a year. One of these sessions, and they're 8 hours in length, split over 2 days, right, is a license proficiency check. So the CAA obviously lie down some criteria that we have to be observed to be proficient in, such as engine failures after takeoff, stops, before V1, and various other sort of ticks in the boxes, really, in terms of flying the approach, various approaches the Airbus can do. So to a degree on that one, we sort of know what's coming a little bit. And then the other one we do, obviously, 6 months later. So we're always in the simulator, sort of no longer than sort of a 6 month gap. It's more sort of dictated by the airline. So generally it's split again into 2 days. The first day is more of an examination. So you face some unknown failures and obviously deal with them from there. And you're observed obviously by the trainer who sat in the back and will then give you some feedback on how you did. And obviously you need to perform to a certain standard, but of course they'll say, you know, there's a training element to it as well. So that, you know, as long as a safe outcome was achieved, that's the main aim. But obviously, you know, if this happens to you in real life, you could have also thought about this and this. So that's great. And then day two, that is also again more sort of geared towards training. So it can be sort of any number of things. You know, if the airline's bringing in maybe new SOPs or procedures, then we could be sort of talking through those and practicing those in the simulator. Or if maybe sort of the rates of certain occurrences have gone up, long landings or toga 10s, those type of situations, if those have sort of been slightly on the increase, then it might be that the training department have come up with a training package to maybe help lower those rates again.
And this recent simulator session was over 2 days, and on day one you tweeted a rapid decompression and posted a rather scary picture of you in an oxygen mask. What happened?
So we were got into the cruise and everything was going well, and then we heard a rather large sort of bang from a big speaker, but obviously simulated to be from the cabin, followed by a warning that we'd had a loss of pressurization. So obviously we then carry out our drills and actions straight away for that. And obviously the first one for us is to make sure we've got our oxygen masks on, particularly at very high altitudes, you know, 39,000 feet. Your what they call time of useful consciousness, which although you would remain conscious longer than sort of a few seconds, your brain wouldn't really be able to function to a degree where you could, you know, fly an aircraft. So the first thing to do is obviously get an oxygen mask on, get oxygen into your lungs again, and from then you can deal with everything else. And obviously the main part then is to get the aircraft down to a safe altitude where the obviously air is a lot thicker and people can start breathing normally again.
On day two, you had the dreaded electrical emergency config. Can you talk us through what this is and how pilots deal with it?
Sure. I probably shot myself in the foot with this one because last time I was on, you asked me what the one I disliked the most was. And of course,
absolutely, we did.
I said that, so guaranteed it myself in the next sim session. But funnily enough, we actually put ourselves into the emergency electrical configuration. It was a conscious decision between the captain and myself to actually do that for the reason I've just sort of alluded to. It was on day two. We had a simulated smoke scenario where we had smoke in the cockpit. As our drills went on, it became to the point where we couldn't identify positively the source of the smoke. And so that procedure requires us to turn off all non-essential electric systems, hence putting ourselves into what we call the emergency electrical configuration, which basically keeps the bare minimum of systems running.
And you successfully were signed off through this proficiency test, so well done.
Thank you very much.
I suppose the question everyone wants to ask is, have any of these checks you've been given in the sim ever happened in real life?
Fortunately, and I'm touching wood while I'm saying this, certainly the ones that would constitute sort of very dangerous or difficult situations, no, I've never had. Some of the things we train for in the simulator, so they aren't quite as sort of disastrous as sort of the ones we've talked about today, like the smoke and the emergency decompression and the emergency electrical config. Some of them are sort of much more benign events that do happen, but obviously still require a degree of proficiency and the right reaction to one that we had this week. We had a sick passenger on board, and of course that required a diversion sort of as soon as possible to get on the ground. And obviously, you know, it's made sure that we run through all the correct things, do the diversion safely, obviously, and make sure that we continue to fly the aircraft safely through that. But also, you know, where possible, obviously arrange for medical staff to assist the passenger on the ground, communication with the cabin crew to make sure we're in the loop with the situation so we can pass any details to air traffic. Yeah. Obviously, making sure the other passengers are aware what's going on and, you know, not why we've suddenly landed in a completely different airport in a different country. So yeah, and some of these things have happened in real life, unfortunately, but certainly, touch wood, none of the real tricky ones.
Wind shear. Okay, well, thanks very much for that, Steve. Just before I let you go, you were talking earlier and you mentioned that Aer Lingus and BA have opened up sponsorship schemes for training. We talked about your training a few years ago. What are your thoughts on this?
I think it's a great step forward. I mean, I haven't looked into the schemes in great detail. The major stumbling block for people nowadays is the finances. In years and years gone by, the airline picked up the tab, and sort of post September the 11th, obviously airlines were less keen to do that. And at that stage, really, sort of the banks stepped in, and at the time were supplying sort of unsecured loans to people that had, you know, were going through pilot training. They would then start repaying that loan. Since the credit crunch has kicked in, obviously, the banks haven't been able to give these unsecured loans anymore. So the financing option available to people was to get a secured loan. And obviously, very, very few people are able to secure a loan of that magnitude. So I think the people coming through training, or able to come through training, I should say, and get their license in the last few years has been fairly minimal. So it would appear that the Aer Lingus and British Airways are maybe beginning to react to this. Now, as I say, I haven't looked into the schemes in detail, and I know there's still a percentage of the training costs that has to be bared by the cadet prior to commencement of the training, and then obviously repayment of, I would imagine, the full amount once you know, the training has been completed and you know, you get a job. But of course, by that time you've got the job and
can
afford to start repaying that back.
Well, I think it's really, really good news for the industry that that those two airlines are starting to do it. And I know with the growth with your employers, there's certainly some opportunities coming up.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully so. I mean, as I say, if we can get good people sort of through the training, and the only way to do that is to open up sort of avenues for financing. And this is obviously the first step to that. So let's hope it continues for a long time.
Well, Steve, thanks again for joining us, especially as it's on your time off. Where can the listeners find you online?
I'm on Twitter, and my handle, as a former glider pilot, my handle is @ThermalHound.
Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thanks again, Peter. Speak to you soon.
You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
All right, thank you, Peter, for the Across the Pond segment. Okay, moving on to listener mail. First comes from Bob Iverson. Bob had a question about the Air France 447, flight 447. He asked, doesn't even an advanced airliner like the A330 have an attitude indicator, or even an old-fashioned steam gauge, or EFIS? He says, it seems to me that they must, and if so, the flight crew must have disregarded it, since it certainly would have told them the plane was in a nose-high or stalled attitude. Rob, this is kind of interesting, because as I was reading the reports of the Air France crash, don't you know as a pilot what the attitude of the airplane is?
Well, yes. Yes.
Nasty
and no.
Or obnoxious? Oh, I'm sorry, wrong attitude.
No. That's the attitude of the pilot, not the attitude of the airplane. Actually, yes and no. You only know the attitude of the airplane two ways, either by looking at the instruments and noticing where the nose of the airplane is relative to the earth, or by looking out the window. And if it's dark and it's out over the ocean, there's the horizon, so you don't have that as a backup. If you were in the clouds, you wouldn't have a backup, visually, I'm saying. But when the two main systems went down, the two, as it seems to be, the primary flight displays went under that gave them airspeed indications and apparently attitude information. The backup, which is Mr. Iverson mentioned, it's a small EFIS. It's a small little glass-paneled attitude indicator that has airspeed and altitude of its own. Of course, the airspeed didn't work because all three of the pitot tubes had iced up, and even the backup attitude indicator pulls airspeed information from one of those pitot tubes. But regardless of that, it still, at least as far as we know, should have provided perfectly usable attitude information. So the question is, what in the world, how bad were things? What kind of turmoil was going on in that cockpit that no one thought to look at the attitude indicator of the backup, which is exactly why it's there? That's one of the great unknowns on this yet.
And you think that's something that we'll ever really know for sure, or it's just going to remain a mystery?
Well, I think we're going to have more information. I mean, the report that came out week before last was 100 and, oh my goodness, I have it on my netbook. I think it's probably 140 pages, and I haven't even gotten through all of it yet, but it seems to be much more detailed than the initial report was. But exactly why they did not look at that instrument or something, and why they could not tell that the aircraft was falling, that's going to be a toughie. That particular answer is going to be a toughie.
Yeah. Okay.
Rob, isn't there a checklist that you go through to check this, check that, as you go if in a situation like that?
Well, essentially, we have to go back to the start of the incident. I mean, they were flying level at 35,000 feet. The pitot's iced up, and without accurate airspeed indications, the autopilot said, something's wrong here. And the autothrottles also said, something's wrong here. We better give it back to the humans. So they basically disconnected and said, you know, because we don't think we're getting reliable information anymore, we better give it back to the humans. And they just let go and said, okay, guys, you're on your own. But, of course, from what it looks like, the attitude instruments in the cockpit were not giving reliable indications either. It was dark, again, outside with no horizon. We can't be certain if they were in the clouds or not, but it actually doesn't even make any difference because, again, at night over the ocean, there is no horizon. There's no up. There's no down. You can't tell left from right. And the pilots just simply did not know what to do. The first thing they did, the pilot flying, was to bring the stick back, which increased the pitch attitude, which made the airplane climb, which no one's quite sure why he did that. And then they held the stick back to the point that the stall warning went off, and the airplane remained stalled all the way down to the water. And no one can quite figure out what could possibly have been going through the heads of three pilots all kind of standing there watching this happen. It's pretty scary, but we're all doing some digging.
All right. Certainly more to come on this topic. Yeah.
Good question, though, Bob.
Okay, Kimo wrote in again. You know, we've been talking about weight and balance and using passengers to affect balance on an airplane. He wrote in to say that at least on some of their 767s that they fly to a certain location, they do a little bit of passenger moving around for a slightly different purpose. Now, he says that the passengers at this particular location are heavier than normal. He says, so if we pack them in, the floor limited weight would be exceeded, and possibly the cabin floor would collapse. He says, so we block one seat per row in Zone B, which I believe comes out to 12 seats total that are blocked. And again, it's not because of a weight and balance issue, but it's a limitation on the floor loading. That's kind of interesting. I had never run across that before.
What are they carrying? Sumo wrestlers or what?
I guess some heavy folks. And Kimo also had a comment on evacuation because we were mentioning that, I think, last episode about the requirement for the maximum evacuation time. And he says, I believe the FAA requirement to evacuate an entire airplane is 3 minutes. He says, for a demonstrated mini evacuation, it is 90 seconds. So what's a demonstrated mini evacuation? He says, it's an evacuation with no passengers, and it's the minimum required with the minimum required crew on board and only using half the exits. The time starts when the command of evacuate is given by the captain. So thanks to Kimo. Good to hear from you again. We also got a note from Paul Filmer, one of our listeners, one of our past guests and a fantastic aviation photographer. And he had some information on the Trident, which we had mentioned last time. He said it was the world's first. Now, David, you should pay attention to this. He says it was the world's first trijet aircraft. Yes, it was before the 727. It could employ, now this is very interesting, it could employ reverse thrust in the air to achieve descent rates of over 4,500 feet per minute. Boy, that must have been dramatic. These days, modern aircraft, the thrust reversers deploy in air, it's pretty much all over. He also says it was the first automatic landing by a civilian, a civil airliner in scheduled passenger service in June 1965. And the first blind landing in scheduled passenger service in November 1966.
But they're talking about no one being able to see out the window. They're not talking about the state of the pilots.
I assumed, yeah, yeah.
Okay, I was just checking.
So Paul passed along some additional information, too, on that. So we thank Paul for that. You can find Paul at www.skippiescage.com. Great site,
but
great
did
photos.
Did they ever make it into a tanker?
No, you didn't make it into a tanker, David.
I had something to add.
Yeah?
Because, interestingly, as Paul excludes, and this is what British people do, they manipulate people and facts.
Just the British?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, obviously all Americans are honest. Apparently, even though the 727 was about a year later in first flight, in terms of entrance into service, the 7-2 actually beat the Trident by a few months.
Ah.
And according to some research I did, apparently BEA had actually suggested that Boeing and Hawker actually work together on a trijet aircraft because they're both working on designs, and obviously that did not happen.
Dan, I thought you were the guy who said he didn't know any history of aviation before he was born.
Well, when I actually look things up, magic
happens.
Okay,
research.
Obviously, Dan is not a political science or sociology major from the way he introduced that comment. But
I'm sorry. I love the British people with such a deep, burning passion. I'm going to stop talking now.
Dan, that's right. You better. Okay. From Tony, this was probably the email that generated the most follow-on email between us geeks that I can remember in quite a while. Tony asked, he says, hello from England. Can the geeks shed any light on why Alaska use Bobby Six Killer as the logo on their aircraft tails?
I tried to give an answer, but Rob didn't like it.
I didn't understand it. What is now for people who don't know, Alaska has this graphic image. On the tail.
His name's Charlie. He's an Inuit Eskimo, and he's basically a composite image. He's not anybody in particular, although a lot of people think he looks like somebody, but he really is just an Eskimo face, and believe it or not, Alaska Airlines tried taking him off, and the rest of the state revolted, and they had to put him back on.
Yes, to add some additional colors,
navy blue and white. There's no color to him, dear.
As far as I know, there is no official name of the Eskimo. But there have been names and tossed around, and also, you know, who exactly was the model for that's been tossed around. But according to Alaska, David said it's a artist composite of a native Alaskan. But apparently, this specific tail was one of four liveries introduced in the 1970s, and it was the current tail that remained.
Huh. Well, that's a striking image, and it's, I would advise them to keep it. It's.
I kind of like it. I mean, yeah. In a land of very boring tails
in the
U.S. industry, I think it stands out.
Yeah.
Well, actually, and what I like is on certain 737s, the Inuit man on the Alaska tail actually has a lei on him.
Ah.
In the Hawaiian service that Alaska does.
Hmm. Clever.
Hmm.
Next email came from Ryan. I'm going to turn this into a question for our pilots, Rob and Max Trescott. From Ryan, who's been holidaying in Canada, and he's been spending some time, he says, photographing aircraft landing at Vancouver Airport. And he sent a link to some of his photos, which we can put in the show notes. But here's Ryan's question. He says, I've noticed late afternoons here means the sun is right down the runway, and aircraft are flying directly into it. And he took some pictures of it to sort of illustrate that. But my question is, what does a pilot do when you're on the runway and the sun is, you know, straight directly ahead? What do you do?
It's the same problem that people face when they're driving a car, and often what you end up doing is trying to block the sun either with your hand or a chart or anything you have so that you can get a better view. Just to give you an extreme example, one of the worst cases I ever remember was when I was landing at Fraser Lake Airport here in Northern California. Fraser Lake has a grass strip next to a canal, which they land float planes on. I was landing on the grass strip at the time, but the sun was directly in my eyes. I could not see the grass strip. And so what I did is I looked out to the side, and I kept watching the canal as a reference so that I could land on the grass.
So there's no magic aviator sunglasses that are going to remove the sun.
No, I wish. It's just a problem we all have to deal with.
Okay.
No, and you know, it's really fun, too, when you're flying propeller airplanes, single-engine propeller airplanes. It always seems like just as you're about to flare, as you're pulling the nose up and the prop is really slowing down, it starts flashing through the sun, and it's almost like you're blinking five times a second just as you're trying to find the runway, and it makes you crazy. It really does.
I bet.
You don't paint your propellers, the back of your propellers, black?
Well, that wouldn't really help because it still cuts through the sunlight. That's the real problem.
It's like a shutter, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Huh. Mm. Okay, well, I think that'll do it for this episode. I want to thank everyone for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Again, our guest this episode was Max Trescott. You can find him at www.maxtrescott.com. And Max, you're also on Twitter.
That's right. You can find me on Max, M-A-X, Trescott, T-R-E-S-C-O-T-T, on the Twitter.
Great. Any place else people should look for you, or are those the two main spots?
Oh, you can also check out g1000book.com, and that's our business site.
Okay, great. We want to thank Steve Vischer this time for the Australia Desk Report. We look forward to Grant McCarran joining him next week. Also, we want to thank Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond segment covering European aviation. Okay, let's tell folks where they can find us online. David Vanderhoof, we'll start with you.
I can be found online when the internet seems to be working, on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, or on my blog, which is whatjustflewby.com.
Very good. And Rob Mark, where do people find you?
Well, they'll find us on Twitter, us. Wait a minute.
Yeah, that's the royal.
Is somebody
us,
here with me? Well, Simba's with me. Yeah. So they'll find Simba and I at jetwine.com and on Twitter at jetwine.
Excellent. And Dan Webb, how about you?
You can find my blog about the airline industry at thingsinthesky.com, but you have to believe that you can find it. And also you can find me on Twitter at Dan Webbage, or do what some people are doing and keep adding me on Google Plus, even though I have no idea what the hell I'm doing with it.
And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory or on Twitter at Max Flight. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com. This is episode 160. You'll find links to all the sites that we mentioned on this podcast. Also, you can put in some listener comments there if you like. Be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream this podcast to your mobile phone. If you'd like to send us email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we also have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Normally, Benay Wilson gives us that number, but Benay is not with me today. So, Rob, maybe you could fill in.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thanks, Rob. Pretty good. That's a pretty good Benay.
I sense an angry email from Benay being sent right now.
We love all emails from Benay.
Wait a minute. Let's just be real clear. I know we're out of time, but we've got to say that we do have that photo that was taken at AirVenture that shows that Benay Wilson and I are twins that were separated at birth.
That's right.
It proves it.
It proves it. Beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Beyond a shadow.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at www.brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Night, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
I used to have a 1960 Falcon.
It was a Ford Falcon.
It was underpowered also, and I was actually always getting lost, but I was in the Falcon. So there's probably a very close relationship here, I think.
Rob, you're back with us now?
I'm afraid I am, yes.
Okay.
Well, I'm not afraid I am. I mean, I am.
Okay.
Sounded kind of strange. Hey, Max, is there any truth to the fact that you're trying to outsource our show? I mean, I've heard rumors to the fact that you're trying to hire people in other regions of the world that can do what we do for much less money than David and Dan and I.
Not David, but yeah, China, actually.
Uh-huh. I see.
Sorry.
Do you think anyone will realize that it's not us?
Well, we'll find out, I guess.
Robert, nobody can replace you. You should know that by now.
Yeah. Me and my dog. I know a lot of guys that like to get laid.
Yeah. Okay. That's coming out.
I'm sorry. I couldn't mess it up.
He hung it out there, huh?
Yeah, he did.
Oh, God. All right, sorry. Now you know I'm in severe therapy.
Yeah.